I just want to introduce the next speaker. His name is Ben Guja. He's the lead engineer of Mozilla Firefox. Firstly, just want to thank Ben and his fiancée, Leslie, for coming all the way down to New Zealand to give this talk. It's a great privilege to have you here. Ben spent most of his life in Auckland. He was actually born in the UK, and he now lives in the US, where he works for Google. His interests include cars, potato chips, and filmmaking. And before he was employed at Google, the job title on his card was Getaway Driver. Please give a big Webstock welcome to Ben Guja.
Thank you. Let's get the... Excellent. Okay, well, thank you for the lovely introduction, Ben. I'm here today to talk about Firefox and a bunch of things about it. To start with, I'm going to talk about the origins of Firefox and the Mozilla project, reaching back several years in time, the environment that led to the creation of Firefox, as well as some of the pillars of success, things that have allowed Firefox to be as successful as I think it has been. I'll talk a little bit about Mozilla project and web standards, and also some of my thoughts about software development in New Zealand. I'll take this thing. So if we look back in time, we'll turn back the clock about 7, 8 years now, and we look at the situation that led to the creation of the Mozilla project as it exists today. These are the origins of Firefox and other Mozilla projects. By 1998, late 97, early 98, Netscape, which was the company that made the dominant browser for a long period of time, was in trouble. They were shipping Netscape 4, which some people here may remember with some irritation, and they were trying to come up with a new version called Netscape 5, and they were basically finding themselves in a bit of trouble, mostly because they were trying to continue development on a code base that they had thrown together in haste, basically, in 1994, and it sort of had grown organically over time without much of a sustainable plan for its growth. And during that period of time, between 94 and 98, web technology had advanced rapidly, and there were many new functionality for web developers and stuff like that that they had to support. Their support matrix was also very large. They had to support Windows, Mac, and Linux, and a bunch of other platforms that they also produce software for. So it was difficult for them to develop software quickly, and they were also facing stiff competition. Now, industry pundits had said at the time that the web was going to be the platform of the future, that desktop applications would move online, and Netscape wanted to capitalize on that. And also, Microsoft saw an opportunity in this space, too. And what Microsoft did was it came up with its own browser, Internet Explorer. And during this time period, Microsoft did an excellent job of keeping Netscape honest with a number of very compelling releases to Internet Explorer. Each one had more features for users and developers, many interesting new capabilities. So it was tough for a company to keep up with all of the things that were going on. So around the start of 1998, the company made a couple of interesting changes. One was that they decided to distribute their communicator product for free. And another one, the most interesting one, I think, is that they decided to give away the source code to the browser that they were working on at the time, which is Netscape 5. And the idea behind that was a couple of things. One is that they wanted to get software developers from around the world who were interested in web technology. They wanted to get those people who were interested in that technology to contribute, to help fix bugs, implement features, people who cared about platforms that in the Netscape product line had traditionally lagged behind, like Linux and Mac, people who are really passionate about those platforms, engage them and get them to help make sure that the software worked really well. And also for good PR. Netscape would appear generous. It was giving away this huge lump of code and so on. And there was also an additional PR win that may or may not have planned for. And that was that in what the press were casting at the time as this big battle of the browsers between Netscape and Microsoft, what creating this sort of pseudo-independent organization would do is galvanize support amongst the various communities out there, open source people, web standards people, and so on, behind this sort of independent organization. And that was actually the motivation for a lot of people who would volunteer to the project as time went on. So Mozilla actually started as a group within the Netscape company, much like any large organization. There were different teams. The Mozilla group had a team. And their job was to handle the source release, to release code, to provide a infrastructure for collaborative development with tools like CVS and Bugzilla and other stuff like that to allow developers to come together and work in the open. So this went on for a little while, and the source code that, like I said, for Netscape 5 was opened up. And things were going a little slowly, but in terms of volunteers getting involved, but the software was progressing along towards Netscape 5. So what happened towards the end of 1998 was that it became increasingly clear to people that the code base that they were working on was not going to provide them with a good framework to build on for the future. The rendering engine by that time was called Mariner, and while it was light years ahead of Netscape 4 in terms of the things that it could do, it had fixed many issues with standard support. It also did things like when you reloaded a page that had tables, when you resized a page that had tables, it didn't reload the whole page, and other stuff like that, which were really irritating web developers with Netscape 4. But still, it wasn't the best foundation upon which to build a future browser. So people within the company, and also people like groups like the Web Standards Project, lobbied to switch to a new rendering engine that was being developed. And that was called ng-layout, and it's also gone by other names like Raptor. It's now called Gecko. So towards the end of 1998, finally a consensus was reached, and a decision was made to switch away from the old layout system to the new one. And this was a very risky move. A couple of reasons for that. One was that Netscape 5 was probably 3 or 4 months away from shipping. And what the transition to Gecko meant was, because of the way the old code was architected with these strong links between the front and back end, basically the entire old code base would have to be thrown away, and everything started again from scratch on this new technology. So it was very risky, and it ended up costing the project several years of development time before a stable product ended up shipping off the new technology. But it was a good move because the new architecture has allowed us to be much more flexible and successful. So after this transition, many things happened. The user interface of the application began to be built up in a way that allowed more people with web development backgrounds, people like myself, to become involved. And the project, the code became a little cleaner and so on. People began joining the project. And as that happened, some problems became apparent. And these were sort of systematic problems with the Netscape organization and how it was handling its involvement with open source. Now, some of those things are, one is that even though it was a new generation bubble company, it was one of the companies that started the, the dot-com boom, it had by this time rapidly expanded. It was initially a very small company, just a startup, and it now had thousands of employees. And the hierarchies within that organization now reflected much more traditional company. What the situation was is that there are many people in senior positions where the senior position was a function of either years of experience in the tech industry, but not necessarily the system that people in an open source community would understand. The hierarchies that existed seemed a little arbitrary. In the open source world, the respect that you get, or the rank, if you will, in terms of a traditional hierarchy, is based on the quality of your contribution. Whereas for Netscape, what had happened during its rapid expansion was that their hiring standards, their hiring bar, had lowered quite a lot. And so people who didn't really understand open source and didn't have that much interest in it were now on the front lines of this open source project. And it turned out that engaging fully with the open source world turned out to be too large a procedural and cultural transition for the people at the company. And some of the effects of this were that what happened was that a lot of decisions, people would make decisions in the same way that they always had. Like if you had a team, you would have a team meeting and discuss things and then do them. This is inside of the company, but you wouldn't necessarily communicate how you'd made that decision or why to the outside world. And so what was happening was that the browser was changing, things were happening, but people in the open source world who were volunteering, who were giving a lot of their time up, weren't really getting any sense that they were involved. And that's kind of put people off a little. In his book, Carl Fogel says, his book is Producing Open Source Software, he says if people get the sense that decisions are being made mysteriously behind the scenes without, without possibility of their input, it's like sprinkling contributor account on your project. So it was very interesting. Actually, I went backwards. So what happened at the same time was there are all sorts of other internal dysfunctions within the company aside from that. Netscape.com was the web portal, the website at Netscape.com where people would go and read about things like what Britney Spears was doing this week and all that sort of stuff. And that, by this time, since Communicator was now being given away for free, was generating most of the revenue for the company. And the managers that worked there were very keen to point that out whenever they could to the people in the browser group. And rather than just saying, well, we want you to build a good browser and people will use it, and if the homepage is set to Netscape.com, we'll make money through ads or whatever, their approach was to more aggressively micromanage the development of the browser itself. And so what happened was the Netscape.com people had a bunch of ideas like, well, let's put rows of links to our site into the browser window itself and make people stare at that, because if there are links there, they'll click on them and we'll make money. Let's put lots of ads for partners. Let's even make the browser look like it merges into this one design iteration of our site so that it looks like this one big package. Never mind the fact that users might, heaven forfend, want to visit another website where it doesn't actually fit in with, or that they themselves might change their design later on. And at the same time, Netscape was convinced that it had to build up its full suite of applications again and ship them in a single entity, single package at the same time. And this was, I think, one of the reasons why the decision was made to abandon the old code and switch to Gecko as quickly as it was done, even though the old code could probably have shipped in about 3 or 4 months, but it would have shipped only with a browser and not with mail. So the requirements list for recreating the Communicator suite was very long. There was a browser, there was the mail reader, the authoring software Composer, there was an address book and all these various other different pieces. And getting all of these things to work right was a daunting task. And Netscape had, I think, about 100 engineers in Mountain View who worked hard and fast on trying to get all these pieces together. And in the year 2000, sort of a siege mentality set in amongst the executives in the browser group, browser, mail, et cetera, client group. They basically knew that if they didn't ship a new Netscape product in the year 2000, that they would be fired. So the attitude became, well, let's just get everything together as quickly as we can, and we'll just throw it over the wall and hope it sticks. And hopefully, if we cross our fingers and just hope really hard, it won't suck. Well, we all know what happened. And Netscape 6 shipped to the world. It had terrible usability. It was weighed down by all of these distractions and taskbars with links to Netscape.com. There was poor performance. It was sluggish. It took ages to start up. It took ages to visit pages, ages to open new browser window. It was not very stable. It would crash. It was not a good product. And you know, a bunch of us worked on it, and we're sitting there, we're just sort of, oh, no. It was more like an alpha. It wasn't even beta quality. The market, the people who had waited all of this time to see the exciting new Netscape release, basically sighed a heavy, to hell with this, and went to other browsers. Mostly, just people just gave up and used Internet Explorer. And people said, you know, that it was a joke. This had to be a joke. Many people who had had a lot of hopes for the Mozilla project at its inception now became very disillusioned. It seemed like this wasn't going to work, this idea. So what then happened after all that is, as Netscape went into this massive salvage operation, trying to make the best of a bad situation. All of the executives were turned over, as they feared. And people began making, you know, incremental improvements and improving the core technology. And Netscape did a bunch more releases, 6.1, 6.2, 7 series, and so on. And during this time, over the next couple of years after Netscape 6, engineers at the company and volunteers around the world actually made some really significant improvements to the technology. It became much, much faster. It became much more compatible, worked with more web pages. It was more stable. Memory usage dropped. There were all of these campaigns within the project and within the Netscape company where performance tests were instituted, and people went on campaigns to reduce memory usage and all these sorts of things. So basically the browser became a lot more solid. But at the same time, the product management and marketing people, especially on the Netscape.com side, were still brain dead. And things like, for instance, one of the engineers that I worked with implemented pop-up blocking actually in the browser. And the Netscape.com people said, well, you can't ship that because our site uses pop-ups on the front page and our advertising will go away. It never occurred to them that pop-up blocking would be a feature that users would want, and it would actually go and download the browser to get it. So the Netscape product shipped with pop-up blocking completely removed, while at the same time the unbranded Mozilla product shipped with pop-up blocking enabled. Now you can think of, if you think of what the news media press or someone at news.com or someone who's reviewing this product might say if they look at the two of them side by side. Well, Netscape product sort of looked like a joke. And so as a result, after more and more negative reviews and all that sort of stuff, despite all of the good work that was going on, Netscape became the walking dead. People within the browser part of the company, at least, and other areas, began to focus their energies not on so much making the product better, because we'd argued with the people at Netscape.com, and they always won because they held the money, but just on trying to find ways to save our own jobs. And so in this sort of vacuum of product management leadership and engineering leadership, the software that was the Mozilla application suite sort of bloated a little more, got more stuff in it that wasn't part of any plan or necessarily having it used to anybody. And so during the time between early 2000 and, 2003, 2002, market share for Netscape Mozilla browsers shrunk from about 15% to the low single digits. And it was this defeat, it was from the ashes of this defeat that a bunch of new alternatives rose. And there were people, volunteers and also people within the company that had for a long time been wanting to actually take this really interesting technology that had matured, that had become more stable, and do something good with it. I remember one point when I was back in 2000, even before Netscape 6 shipped, director of the browser group came over and said, we just need to get together. I need to take you up to my cabin at Tahoe, all of you people, and I'll give you some liquor, and we'll sit there for a weekend, and we'll just make this thing not suck. So what happened then is, in 2002, a bunch of us began looking at new ideas for web browsers, and we had a little extra time, and now that we're focused mostly on less interesting AOL work, because that was what paid the bills, our spare time, we spent looking at other interesting ideas. And a couple of these have become successful. One is Firefox, and another is Camino. And what these products did was they embodied the vision that the Mozilla community as contributors had during those dark days of Netscape 6 and following. The idea was to build usable software for everyone. And I think we've been pretty successful so far. So the first real delivery of this was Firefox 1.0. And it shipped on November 9, 2004. Since that time, Firefox 1.0, 1.5, and so on, all the associated security updates, have had over 177 million downloads. Our initial download target was to get 10 million downloads in 10 days, and we managed to do that pretty easily, which was a big surprise to everybody, because for a time we thought, well, no one knows about us. Why would that many people come and download it? In the period of time since Firefox 1.0 shipped, we have grown in market share to about 12-25%. I think about 12% in the United States and about 25% in parts of Europe where it's more popular, and also across different interest groups. Tech people tend to like Firefox more than the average consumer. I think 12% is the average consumer figure. And Firefox has been the browser that has been the most successful browser since IE at gobbling up market share. So we're very surprised and flattered by the people that like and enjoy using Firefox and all the feedback that they give us. So we've been quite successful. And I think that there are some reasons for this. Some of them are sort of outside of our control, but when I think about the product management, engineering, project management reasons for this, I can think of four key ones. One is having a product focus. Another is being ambitious. Another is being realistic. And then finally is this open source development model that we use. First, I'm going to look at product focus. And it's going to seem pretty obvious to everybody, but the idea is that we would not think about ourselves as engineers who are using a software, not thinking of this as sort of a project that we were working on for necessarily just our own benefits, but think about users everywhere. Try and step outside ourselves and think about what other people might think of this. Build a browser for everyone. And what this meant was adopting a new set of ideals for product development. One of those ideals is that less is more, and that we'll take a look at pieces of user interface within the browser and remove buttons, remove controls, options, and text, make everything seem clearer. People should be able to figure things out at a glance. Choose a better set of defaults. Feature for feature, Firefox is in many ways very similar to the application suite that it replaced, but for instance, in the application suite, you had to go into preferences and turn on pop-up blocking. We thought, well, people hate pop-ups. Almost everybody hates pop-ups, so why not just block them by default? So that's one of the things we did. Another thing was to look at the sort of things that people like to change in options. And if something was likely to be changed by about 15% of people, then we would make a option for it in user interface. If it was more of an esoteric thing, then we would let people either use about config or build an extension or something like that. The approach that we took was to basically look at what there was there in the CMonkey application suite and basically strip it all down, all the stuff that didn't seem to be as important to start with, and then build up or rebuild features into the things that we wanted them to be. One of those things that we built back in that wasn't there before was the extension manager, the extension API, that allowed third-party developers to build add-ons to Firefox outside of the development cycle of Firefox itself, so that people could create additional functionality. And if someone really missed something that had been removed from CMonkey, they could create an extension to add it back, or someone else would, and they could benefit from that by using it. And people would come up with a whole bunch of interesting new features as well. Another thing was to empathize with users. Like I said, trying to think about actual users and not just considering a tech-savvy audience, but considering sort of a mass-market audience with the idea that if we make it work well for everybody, even advanced users will be more efficient at what they do. So we looked at the application suite, and what had happened there you know, especially over the years as Netscape became less and less interested in browser development, is the application suite had sort of become this hodgepodge of solutions that and features that met the needs of the people that worked on them, that contributed to them through open source, or even people within Netscape itself, where there was one engineer assigned to a very tiny piece of functionality. And so since that was his world, he would focus on that and, you know, over-engineer that as much as possible to keep looking useful. And these sort of things were really, some of them were only useful to skilled developers. Some of them might be useful to everybody, but they only made sense to skilled developers. So what we wanted to do is we tried to change that and try and make it seem more usable to everybody. And we got a lot of criticism. People said that we were dumbing down the product, that it was just for advanced users, that it was bad for advanced users. And I think that this is, you know, we got a lot of that criticism. And I think that today, I think a lot of people who are very technically savvy enjoy using Firefox. So I think what the criticism that we get for dumbing down, I think is a good example of what I call localized expertise. I think that by advanced users, when someone says this sucks for advanced users, what they mean is this sucks for people who are very familiar with the Mozilla browser project or you know, Mozilla browsers, browser development in general. You know, like Russ said before, there are, you know, little groups of people who have their own set of ideas where things are perfectly logical to them because of the sort of cultural group that they're in or the profession, et cetera. And that was the case here. My example that I give is that you could probably consider me to be a fairly advanced user of web browsers, or at least of Firefox. I think I know a fair bit about it, although occasionally I find a feature I didn't know before. I'm not really an advanced user of CD burning software. And I like to make CDs so I can listen to them in my car. And for a long time, before software like iTunes and other new stuff came out, it was very difficult. You had to sit there with a command line, sit there and use some tool or some other piece of software, like there was some various Windows software that did it, and you had to create projects and all that sort of stuff. And what I wanted to do was I wanted to be able to just take some songs and put them on a CD. I didn't want to have to read an instruction manual. I didn't want to have to read online help. I didn't want to have to go onto a forum and ask questions. I just wanted to sit down in less than 5 minutes and make a CD. And so that's, you know, that sort of improved over time. That's sort of the approach we've tried to take with Firefox, too, is that there are very intelligent people out there, but they have better things to do than worrying about interfacing with their browser. They just want it to work. So as a case study of this, one of the areas that we've very aggressively product managed was the installation experience. And we did this because installation is the user's very first impression of Firefox as a project. And first impressions count an awful lot. So what we did was we meticulously analyzed and optimized every stage of the installation experience from the moment someone visited the Mozilla.org website to the moment the first browser window popped up on their screen. So we looked at what the status quo was for the application suite, the old application suite. And if you went to the Mozilla.org website, you would see a list of links, and you could choose your operating system, you could choose your language, et cetera. So what we thought was, well, we can automate this. We can use the navigator object, we can figure out what the user's platform is, we can figure out what their language is, and just offer them a link that they can click on. They don't need to make any decisions other than to choose to download Firefox. And so that's the first thing that we did. Next thing was to make the download go as quickly as possible, and that was by keeping our file size down. So with a lot of discipline, going through and trimming out a lot of things that we didn't need or stuff that had been compiled in a long time ago and then was no longer used again and we could now cut out, and by using some more advanced compression technology, we're able to get the download size down to under 5 megabytes, which is roughly the size of an MP3. So what we're able to say to people is, well, you already download MP3s, and it doesn't take that long. You're willing to put up with that weight. Firefox is about the same. And then once it got onto the disk, we fussed over, well, at least I fussed over small details. People laughed at me, but I thought this was interesting. A couple of years ago, actually several years ago, Netscape did some research on how people were installing their software. And what it found was that for, you know, pure novices, what was happening a lot of the time was that they were told to go and download Netscape. They went to the site, clicked on a link, and downloaded it. And when the little box came up that said, do you want to download this? And they hit OK. They actually thought that they'd installed the software, and that was it. And I guess they forgot or didn't realize or ever wonder why there was no Netscape, or maybe thought that was it. So we probably couldn't fix that problem that well, but we could do things to make sure that it was easier for people to see that they had actually downloaded something and maybe run it. So by giving the installer file name a good name, and that turned out to be Firefox setup, just like that, the space in the name. When it got dropped onto their desktop, it would actually wrap there if it wasn't selected so that people might see that there was a setup program for this thing that they've just downloaded, and not just get cropped or have some name like Firefox-1.0.2.3-Win32.x86, whatever, .exe, as is often the case in the open source world. Once people run the installer, we'd really streamlined that. We took out a lot of the choices from the standard installation experience so that people just got the right defaults. They wouldn't feel like it was a hard process to install Firefox. And then once the application started, we really focused a lot on profile migration. And this is something that the Mozilla software in Netscape hadn't really focused a lot on in the past, hadn't really considered that people might be using other browsers like Internet Explorer or Opera, et cetera. And what Netscape 6 and Mozilla did was they just got the IE favorites and brought those in. But people have a lot more state. You know, people have logged into sites with passwords and have then forgotten those passwords. And those are now inside the IE password manager. You know, there are login cookies. There are auto-completion histories. There's settings, all that sort of stuff. So we worked very hard to try and make sure that we got as much of that as possible for a lot of the browsers. And I think that the result of that is that when a user installs Firefox, especially if they're an IE user, that when they start up, what they get is a very familiar and comfortable environment so that they can get started right away and use all of their sites. So this is just a slide. I think one of the things that I think is important, I've always thought is important with software development, is attention to detail. And just to give you an example of outside of the software industry, an automotive example of where I think detail has been particularly successful, at least in my impression. If I take a look at two cars, one is an Audi A6, and the other is a Nissan Maxima. You can see that they both have these fairly common big-ticket line items, electric windows, air conditioning. If you open up the brochure for each car, there's probably a specification table in the back, and it will have those listed, and there'll be a little bullet point next to it. If you actually go and sit in the Audi A6 in a go to a dealership and sit in one, you'll see that if you actually reach into the map pockets in the doors, that there's this felt lining in them. Like, it's really quite nice. What I'm used to, if you drop a hairbrush or a map or something in there, I'm used to like reaching in and having my knuckles scraped off by all of the hard plastic edges, because most people say, well, you can't see that. So why not make it just cheap? But what Audi did was they put this nice felt lining. By the way, this is not sponsored by Audi. But it was this little detail. It wasn't really something that a consumer would point to and say, this is the one reason why I got this product over another. But it is part of what I think is this cumulative feeling of quality. And it's when you combine it with a number of other things like that, people, you know, have more, they feel more positive about the product, they like using it, that adds to their confidence level, it makes them think they're in something that's well engineered. And detail is something that's very important to consider at all phases of the development cycle, you know, especially in the design and development phases. It's not something that can be easily sprinkled on later. I mean, you can try, but it's hard. And generally, towards the end of a development cycle, people aren't thinking about this sort of thing anyway. And it's, you know, very much like accessibility and internationalization. It must really be integral to design and development. Developers have to be thinking about this. And the other thing to be careful of is not to confuse clever details that, you know, make people feel good with esoteric features or over-engineered features. And I know I've done this in the past where I thought, well, this would be really neat if I added this feature and this little thing will be nice and subtle. And it turns out to actually be a big waste of time because no one ever notices and it's over-engineered and adds to the complexity It adds to the testing cost and all that sort of stuff. So there's sort of a balance to be struck, and it's a difficult one. So it's a case study for details, and I think people will decide whether or not this is a worthwhile detail or just esoteric. But Firefox 1.0, 1.5, when you would go to someone's blog site or a news site, and you'd see that little syndicate link or a little XML or RSS icon, you'd click on it, and you'd load the feed page. And instead of actually seeing anything useful, you'd see the XML data, which might be useful to somebody, but not to most people who don't know how to read any of that. And sometimes, depending on how the data was served up, it might just show up as a bunch of random garbage. So during the, so towards the end of the 1.5 product cycle, people thought that, well, maybe we can fix this really quickly. We can just throw in this bundleless extension, and that will show a preview page or apply XSLT style sheet to feeds, and that will work great. We'll just throw that in. Unfortunately, it turned out to be very buggy and didn't work in a lot of cases, and caused performance regressions and all sorts of stuff like that. And it didn't get a lot of little details right. So for Firefox 2, what we decided to do was to try and look at this again, because we thought it was important, and try and come up with a much better user experience, and also make sure that the code integrated well with Mozilla. And also, what this enabled us to do was to get a lot of the little details right. And these were things that I, for instance, when you see this preview page, what happens when you visit a feed is you see a preview page, and a preview page contains some content from the feed, and gives you the ability to subscribe to it in your favorite reader. Your reader could be a desktop application, or it could be a web service, or it could be Firefox's live bookmark system. And this page is part of the browser, and it's on the hard disk somewhere. And what I didn't want to see is when someone clicked on a feed link, I didn't want to see the file URL to that local thing in the location bar. I wanted people to see the actual location of the preview page. And when they hit view source, I wanted people to see the source XML of the feed document itself in the view source window, not the preview page. So these were some details that we managed to get right for Firefox 2. Other important things that have allowed us to be successful, just being ambitious, questioning assumptions that we'd had in the past that was and what was not possible, not being conservative, being very aggressive about our goals, trying to bite off more than we could chew in a bunch of cases, and establishing these stretch goals and working towards them. We tried to do a lot of things, and we ended, extension managers and update systems and all these profile migration and lots of stuff, download managers, and it took a lot of time, but it was worth it. Ambition, though, was tempered by realism. One of the things that we wanted to do, Mitchell Baker came and asked me in early 2004, well, when do you think this thing is going to ship? Well, the documents that I'd written up that time said, oh, maybe May or June 2004. I said, oh, not later than November. And so we really wanted to ship by November, because after sort of mid-November, after Thanksgiving in the United States, people tend to travel and go home and basically check out in terms of new and interesting technological things. So we wanted to make sure that we got the biggest bang for our buck. So what this meant was tightening the belt on features that we'd planned for 1.0. One of the things that we planned to do for Firefox 1.0 was an ambitious rewrite of the bookmarks and history system. You've heard this one before. And what we ended up having to do was to throw it overboard. Wouldn't be the last time. We threw a really effective update system overboard, which is something that we sort of came to regret later on, or at least I came to regret when people from the Mozilla build team came after me with knives for how bad the 1 and 1.0 was. Made it very difficult for them to ship security updates. It was possible. It just required a lot of scripting and all that sort of stuff on the production side to actually get all of that to work. But in the end, we reached November of 2004, and we decided that we should go. We got all of our ducks in a row and pushed the button. What we'd done was we had achieved this critical mass of stability, compatibility, and performance. And we learned from shipping Firefox 1.0 a very important lesson, I think, and that is it's really good to ship software. people can and will use the software if it's decent quality. You know, if it's fundamentally usable, people will use it. Sorry, what was that? It's just, I think it's not so much that any of the pre-1.0 milestones were an individual beta. It was just that we had this idea that we wanted to implement, about 10 different features, and so we just carved that up over the available time into these three-month, 05, 06, 07, 08, 09, and so on. So that was more a function of the fact that the software was being built up rather than testing and feedback. We had a preview release and some release candidates, and that was very useful too. But nowadays we tend to shorten it a little bit. We still have some alphas, but there you go. So towards the end of the 1.0 cycle, we needed to look more at and take some lessons in end-game project management. And come to a realization that nothing is ever perfect in the software development world. And lots of people, like myself and other people, thought that we had all these bugs that were really critical. They were, these polished bugs and things, other critical bugs and things like that. And for what we found is that for every 100 bugs that we think are super critical, there's probably 200 or 300 more, if not even more than that. And that in a lot of cases, users probably don't notice. And this might go against some of the stuff I said before about detail, but if you design your development process to include detail, then you're not going to shoot yourself in the foot too badly at this point. So what we had to do was prioritize the bugs that we wanted to fix based on the impact we thought they would have on real people. And make sure that we ship, even though it's not perfect, make sure we ship something decent. Just don't ship another Netscape 6. I don't think we're in any trouble of that towards the end of 2004. And the other thing that I thought was important following on from 1.0 is to provide meaningful updates to users. And this wasn't the norm for Mozilla. In Mozilla, the application suite was on a 3 or 4 month release cycle. Every 3 or 4 months, a new minor release would come out, 1.1, 1.2, 1.3, 1.4, et cetera. And from the inside of that development process, every release seemed action-packed. There were lots of new features in Gecko, various tweaks to the user interface. But from the outside, users couldn't necessarily see much change with each release. And so their motivation to upgrade each time, it was not clear to them. In fact, if it's not clear why they should upgrade from 1.1 to 1.2, why should they even upgrade to 1.3? And so people would stick to certain old versions because there wasn't really any reason to upgrade, or at least they couldn't see any. So what we tried to do with Firefox was to take a little more time. We tried to get to a 6 month release cycle, but we really haven't been able to do it and get all the features that we want in. So we're on sort of a 12 month cycle at the moment. I think this is good because it's exciting for users. They get to try out the 06 model, much like you would any other product. There is excitement for developers because they get to spend more time, develop more interesting, compelling, ambitious features. And then again, more development for users as they get to enjoy those more ambitious features, rather than saying, oh, look, in this release we changed the wording of the text on this button. Yay. It's now, there's an entirely new, entirely new search system or something like that. So just as a case study in project management, looking at hard decisions that as a project we've had to make very recently. On my blog recently, I talked about the bookmarks and history system, which we call Places. And it was this big new feature for Firefox 2. It was an order of magnitude more complex than any other feature on the list. And what we realized as we worked on it was that it was coming along quite well, lots of interesting possibilities. But to really get it, all of the pieces together, the user interface, the developer APIs, et cetera, we would have to slip the release of Firefox 2 by several months. And while that might seem okay in isolation, the problem is that when you do that for one feature, what you end up doing is you end up suffering a little bit from feature creep as people come along and want to get other non-planned features in because they seem safe and there's more time and all that sort of stuff. And what happens is that sometimes there are interactions between those new features or bugs in them, things that creep in, and you end up slipping even further than you had thought. So what we decided to do was to keep working on Places, but work on it, since it was a more speculative feature, for Firefox 3, and work on it on our development trunk. And for Firefox 2, focus on the remaining features that existed. And there were some quite good ones. So I mentioned before a little bit about open source and Netscape's various attempts at working in the open source environment. But I actually think open source is a really good way for working on software like a browser. Browser is a really, really complex beast. And unless you are a very, very large company who can assign hundreds or thousands of engineers, I'm not exactly sure how that would work, onto a project, open source really helps because you get people who care about individual things, taking responsibility for those things. And at this point, now that there is a Mozilla Foundation and other people around who volunteer, most of the people that work on Firefox and other Mozilla projects today actually started as volunteers, including myself. About 7 years ago, I was a second-year engineering student at the University of Auckland, and this was something I did in my spare time. And I started by lurking on IRC and making posts to news groups, no doubt saying silly things, and making small patches, writing specifications, and stuff like that. And I think that's how a lot of people get involved. Open source with Mozilla, like I said, it got off to a slow start. Not a lot of people joined in initially, and it was difficult. There wasn't very much support infrastructure. Jamie Zawinski, who was a famous early Netscape person, quit in 99, I think it was. And in his resignation diatribe, he said that the project had failed to attract enough volunteers. And people in the press went out and did some research, and they found out that, yes, in fact, most people contributing to Mozilla at that time were paid by Netscape. But over time, as the software has matured, people have become more interested. People have, now that the software is more stable, actually see more of what the initial developers were getting at, and they're more interested and excited to help out. So Mozilla today has very many large and diverse communities. There are the traditional communities that you think of when it comes to open source, like developers, people writing code, fixing bugs, implementing new features. But also people who test, hundreds and thousands of people who download nightly builds, and really brave souls that test code almost as it's written, and alphas as well. Work with engineers to try and find and fix problems. And then there's a lot of people from around the world who contribute localizations and translate Firefox and other Mozilla software into their native languages, which make it one of the most geographically accessible products around. Tech writers who help other developers make sense of everything by documenting APIs and helping people who are web developers or extension developers, et cetera, learn more about building for Firefox and Gecko and so on using web standards. Evangelism teams and so on who help people whose sites are not necessarily well-written or using web standards come to figure out how to use those technologies to their best advantage. And also marketers, people who, in their own time, figure out how to spread the word about Firefox and other Mozilla software through sites like Spread Firefox and so on. So we've become very popular in the past couple of years. And I think that as we grow, and this growth is really exciting, this growth is good, whether we sink or swim as a project will be determined by how well we manage this growth. If you look back in time, back to the small group of people at Netscape in 1994 that were there 24 hours a day hacking away trying to get Netscape 1.0 out the door, the team looks pretty similar to the way the Firefox group did. You can see things went wrong at Netscape. Will the same things happen to Mozilla? Well, I don't think so, but it's not something that we can, as a project, just sit back and expect not to happen. To continue our success, what we need to do is to continue to focus on the ideals that have allowed us to be successful so far. Don't be distracted by what any particular other browser is doing or anything like that. And don't be distracted by what Winston Peters might call the baubles of success. Improve the community infrastructure to handle a project of scale, because that's what we have really become. For instance, Mozilla.org website, it probably fits the definition of a horrid website, like Russ mentioned before. And this is the first view a potential volunteer has on the Mozilla project as an organization. It should be immediately useful to a potential contributor and an existing contributor, and it should communicate the shared values of the people that work on the Mozilla project. A good, solid communications infrastructure with an intuitive taxonomy of groups where people can contribute and feel like they get value out of the time that they take posting and reading and helping people out. And as a project, make sure that we use that for everything. Don't have closed decisions or anything like that. Make sure that we use that really effectively, because today's lurker may be tomorrow's contributor, and that's a story that I know well. Now, I talked a lot about Firefox and its genesis and development and so on, but I haven't really said that much about web standards, and this is a web development conference, so I should say something about that, I guess. I spoke in Auckland last week to some students at the University of Auckland about Firefox. And the question I was asked is, what is Mozilla's focus? Is it on implementing standards, or is it on implementing proprietary APIs? That's a good question, because over the past few years, the focus in the Mozilla project has been on standards. But also, a bunch of other APIs have been implemented. Like, for instance, we've implemented undetectable document.all support, i.e. inner HTML property. So what we try and do is we try, and I'm not personally a Gecko developer, but this is the sort of the feeling that I get, is that we try to implement standards as defined by the W3C and other groups like WattWG, which will eventually find their way back to W3C, and implement tangible extensions when there is a tangible compatibility win. For instance, if we can not compromise our standard support and make sure that a whole bunch of sites work, the Gecko team will do that. And the Gecko team will also look at standards that are available, may not necessarily implement every single one, but we'll take a look at the pros and cons of each. So if I can get on a soapbox briefly here and talk about the feed preview functionality in Firefox 2. One of the issues that came up here was that building this feature, what we discovered was that most feeds are served either with an incorrect content type or with a very non-specific one. What this means is that we end up having to sniff all of the data that comes down over the wire, looking for indications that it's actually a feed. And this means that we end up not respecting the HTTP content type header, which is sad. Oops. What we need to do, what people who write servers, people who publish content, people who write tools need to do is use the most specific content type possible so that we can determine without sniffing what kind of document it is, and write tools that allow users to specify the content type. And standards are important, but it's not just browser developers or server developers. All of us have to take on this responsibility of adhering to them. I don't think this feed handling problem is something that we can probably solve now that it exists, but as new different document formats come up, I hope people will keep this in mind. Just moving on to Firefox 3, taking a look at some of the interesting things there for web developers, well, lots of bug fixes, and actually it's active development time for that now, so if you use the trunk builds and test your web apps and file bugs, there's a good chance that they can be fixed. Improved table layout code. The prospect of ACID 2 compliance, I'm not sure if that's actually going to happen, but we'll see. Looks like it's possible. And one of the things that I find most interesting is very much improved DHTML performance. And by this, I mean, if you've ever developed animation-style applications in Firefox, you may have noticed that depending on what you're doing, the performance can be a little sluggish. So for Firefox 3, the animation there should be as smooth as it is, as it should be, as you want it to be. And underneath all of this, a new graphics architecture that will allow more interesting features for SVG and so on in future Firefox versions. And finally, just before I reach the end of this, looks like I'm only got a few minutes left, I just want to add some notes about software development in New Zealand. I was very grateful here that I had internet access. So a lot of the stuff that I know, I learned just by reading online or talking to people online, getting involved in open source and stuff like that. And I think that, personally, I think that lack of inexpensive broadband is an opportunity missed. Back in California, I pay about $50, $40 or $50 a month for 3 or 4 megabit per second cable, and that's flat rate. There's no download limit or anything like that on it. And I was really sort of, I'd lived here before, and I'd paid, you know, $400 bills a month to Telecom for 1.5 megabit per second connectivity for however much I happened to download. And that was sort of irritating. And I was encouraged to hear just the news just the other week that the government's taking steps to encourage more competition in this space. And I really hope that that works out. I was a little bit disappointed because I was hoping to get up here and wave my arms and say how bad it was, the situation, but I guess maybe it's not so bad after all. I think that affordable broadband is critical because it allows users to get these sophisticated, high-quality, rich applications that use a lot of media. You know, all these new generation of websites like YouTube and stuff like Google Maps, which contacts the server to download all of these images as you drag the thing around. You know, people should have access to that type of application here. There's no reason why people here should not have access to those things. And it encourages developers to build this sort of application for New Zealanders. And it also encourages young people to get involved in software development, the web, business development, open source, all that sort of stuff. So I think that that's good. As New Zealanders, we are a gifted, hardworking people, and we can come up with interesting ideas. We've been very successful in the places that we've managed to break through onto the global stage with our creativity. And I think that software development in New Zealand can be much more than just sales and support for big overseas companies. I think that there can be strong local innovation. And just speaking as myself, as someone who went overseas to find interesting opportunities in software development, that's very exciting. Now, I don't know how much time I have left. Any? Just figured I'd give a brief demo of some of the features in the latest Firefox 2 alpha. Just if I may, we made some changes to tab browsing. If I load this page here, you can see that if I click on links that would typically open new windows, you now get new tabs, which is kind of nice. I can flip back and click on another one here. And you can see that the close buttons are actually in the tab now, which makes them easier to close. And the other thing, too, is we implemented this interesting reselection heuristic so that if you close that, you actually jump back to the right tab, not the one adjacent to it. So that's a lot more usable. It's easier to understand if you use it. Another thing that we did was we implemented inline spell check. So if I go here, and it's a very interesting bug. I love this bug. And if I just type in some misspelled words, they get marked as, actually, I guess you can see it, misspelled. I guess I should move this window over to the right a little bit. What else? There's this feed preview thing that I talked about a little bit before. Here's the BBC News page. If I just quickly click on this thing here, I'll get taken to this preview page, and I can actually go in here and choose a feed reader. Like if I go in here and choose iGoogle, and you can actually see there's a preview page, and if I go back and I can click on the subscribe button, and it will go ahead and I get the option to subscribe to it in iGoogle. Or if I go to another site like cnetnews.com, scroll down towards the end. There's this XML link here. Now that when I click on it, I actually get tossed directly to Google to add it to my page or whatever other thing, blog lines, my Yahoo, et cetera. I have a couple of tabs open here. If I use the force quit on the Mac to simulate a crash, if the browser crashes, it now comes back and will restore the session that was open last time, which is kind of nice. There's some additional search functionality. This is similar to what Microsoft has in IE7. Here's Windows Live. They advertise an open search plugin, and we can now add it here too. I think it will show up in the list, hopefully. There we go. You can now search like that. You can add sites, can publish search engines. Also, if I switch back to Google in here, there is a Google Suggest built right in to the search box and a manager that you can use to add and remove search engines. There's a new add-ons manager and a bunch of other stuff like that. So that's pretty cool. So there you go. There's a brief demo of some of the functionality in Firefox 2. coming soon. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ben. That was excellent. That was really fantastic. I'm always saying it's excellent. Everything's excellent. It's great.